Escape from New Jersey, it's the SNL Nerds, a show where two comics from New Jersey nerd out about Saturday Night Live. I'm your co-host, Darren Patterson.
And I'm your co-host, John Trumbull.
Hey, John, how's it going?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing?
Good. Summer's starting. Summer's here.
Woohoo! Summer hours!
Dancing in the streets. School's out for summer.
Wearing shorts in the studio.
I know. Wearing t-shirts and flip-flops. I mean...
We're casual.
Yes. We're like Tommy Bahama. over here.
Yeah, and so this is exciting because this is our first week of our new summer format.
Yes. For our new listeners, we usually just talk about the newest episode of Saturday Night Live and whatnot. But for the summer, since there's no new episode of Saturday Night Live, did you not know?
Oh my God, I did not get this memo.
Yeah. So because of that, we're going to review Saturday Night Live movies this whole summer.
Yeah.
Are you ready for the summer?
For the CITs. Meatballs.
Yeah. Maybe we should do meatballs.
We could. We could.
That's a very unenthusiastic.
Well, honestly, like the last time I watched Meatballs, it's not a very good movie outside of the Bill Murray parts.
No, yeah, you're right. It's not. All right. So maybe we should.
He elevates some subpar material.
Yeah. Right? Actually, let's not watch it.
I mean, we could do an episode and take an hour to say what I just said in one sentence, but...
You don't want to do that?
We could. No, we could. I mean, I'll watch Bill Murray pretty much any time.
Okay.
This week we are not talking about Meatballs. We are talking about the 1980 film with Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray.
Aykroyd. There it is.
With Dan Aykroyd, Bill... Not Bill Murray.
Oh my God. Get it together, man. Dan Aykroyd, John Belushi, the Blues Brothers came out in...
And cocaine.
And lots of cocaine.
And cocaine.
Came out June 20th, 1980, coming up on the 39th anniversary of it.
Woohoo!
Yeah. And to help us talk about this landmark movie, we have the Lorne Michaels of the podcast here. Mm-hmm. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Frank Ablawi.
Yeah! Hey, guys. Hey, thanks, Frank, for having me. I'm a first-time listener, first-time guest.
Yeah.
You produce the show.
First-time listener.
Wait.
Never. So this is a podcast that's dedicated about not reviewing movies? What was that thing you started off with? You're not doing a movie?
Well, no. We review Saturday Night Live episodes.
But you do Bill Murray movies, but not me.
Well, thanks for coming by, Frank. Has been fun.
I'm not really... The concept of the show doesn't really track well for me. It's okay. You know, you're trying.
Normally... Yeah.
You'll get it straight before it goes on the air, I'm sure. Before the show releases to the public, you'll be fine.
I mean, whoever edits the show, and I'm not sure who does that, because it gets very technical.
One. Yes.
But I'm sure that they will cut out all these dead spots where we're just misspeaking and all that.
Oh, that seems like the right thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I understand that other SNL podcasts do actually edit their shows.
Oh, what? My God. Really?
Yeah, yes. John Murray from the SNL After Party podcast.
Oh, I know that podcast. They review SNL every week.
That's yes.
Yes. I mean, yeah.
Good concept. Good concept. Solid tracks.
Never been done.
Mm-mm.
Never been done.
But we kind of do that too.
All right. So yes, thank you for having me on to talk about Blues Brothers, one of my favorite movies.
Thanks for being here. Yeah. So what's your history with the Blues Brothers? Like, did you see it? I mean, I don't know if you saw it when it came out, but when did it come into your life?
I see one of those movies that's always been there in the background radiation of my life. Like, I've watched it in pieces throughout my childhood. Like, I watched it all the time when I was a kid. Watched it. I think the first time I sat down to watch it straight through was probably in college.
Right.
You know, like, it's one of those movies that's always on, so you get pieces of it here and there.
Right.
But the first time I sat there and watched it from beginning to end was in college with a friend of mine, Rick. Rick Winkler, who's a non-pro alum as well. Oh. And it is...
That's a cool name, Rick Winkler.
Yeah, it's a good
that
one,
is.
Right?
I like it. Is he related to the Fonz?
Probably. Yeah, oh. Cool. I would assume so.
Nice.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah. And it was just... It's such a weird, quirky movie whose DNA is in so many other things that I didn't even realize.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
It's a nice way to put it.
Yeah. It's like we're going right to the end of the movie.
Okay.
Hut, 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 hut,
spoilers.
I love that part.
The hut, hut, hut. I watched it again in preparation for the show last night, And I, again, I've seen it dozens of times when I was younger. It's been a couple of years since I've seen it, but I totally forgot that hut, 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 hut was a thing this movie. And like that, I've seen that in cartoons.
Was that in South Park? I feel like I've seen that in South Park.
I think I've seen it in South Park. I think I saw it in Rock Who's Modern Life.
It's the first episode, I think, of Batman the Animated Series. They bring in a SWAT team and they're all going like, hut, 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 hut.
Yeah. I don't know if it has any, if it existed before then, but I can't imagine. And it's just
But
amazing.
It's hilarious. And it's never commented on. It's just something they do that's just dubbed in.
And so much of this movie is that. It's things that aren't so like, it depends what developmental stage you're at when you watch the movie, you're picking up on things that you've never seen before, right? Even though you've seen the movie before, like you can like it from a cartoon perspective when you're younger, and now you're like, holy crap, they just do not introduce Carrie Fisher's character at all.
No,
that's amazing from like a writing standpoint. So there's so much to talk about, so much good stuff. Absolutely. That's my history. How about you guys?
Well, I mean, it's for me, like, I didn't watch it till like college, because I think in college I had this sort of kick I was on where I wanted to watch like all the comedy movies that I've heard about that people say, oh, if you're a comedy fan, you need to watch this. You need to watch, you know, oh, you need to watch Blazing Saddles. You need to watch Monty Python, The Holy Grail. You need to watch, you know, Blues Brothers and, you know, so on and so forth. So, like, I just went on this kick of just watching all these, you know, comedy movies, Caddyshack and whatnot. And then I saw this and I was like, it took me a while to sort of get the rhythm of it a little bit, just because the tone kind of shifts, because you know, when it opens up pretty dramatically. There's no laughs at all, really. I mean, until because when it opens with Jake, you know, played by John Belushi, being let out of prison and him getting his effects, and he gets it from the corrections officer
played by Frank Oz,
and he's, you know, he says, oh, one prophylactic unused, one soiled.
Yes.
And it's like, why didn't you throw that away? And then that's when I see what they're kind of doing. But then the tone shifts again. It becomes like a screwball comedy in some parts. And then some parts it just becomes like a straight up musical. We're like just choreographed dancing, people singing. And I was like, this movie's all over the place. What is this?
And it gets more and more absurd as it goes on. And by the end, it's just all this over the top cartoonish violence. Well, not really violence, but like everyone in all the forces of good and are after the Blues Brothers.
Yeah. Oh man, that car scene shit at the end.
And it's so wonderfully over the top. Yeah,
it is. It's an amazing thing. So that's when it came. That's when it came into my life. I was like, wow. Once I got what they were doing, I just sat back and enjoyed it. What about you? When did you?
I'm kind of like Frank in that I don't think I consciously remember the first time I saw this movie. It was probably somewhere in my teen years. I know I definitely saw it in college, because I remember I was on like the student entertainment board in college, and we did we would do movies every Friday night for the campus, and one Friday we did like a rock and roll movie night, and we showed the Doors movie, which was very recent at the time, because this is like early 90s. We did the Blues Brothers, we did Spinal Tap, and I don't remember whatever the fourth one was, but I remember I did a poster for that with the Blues Brothers. I mean, I just love this movie for so long, and it's something that, like you were saying, Frank, has always been on TV, so it's like you see it when you're flipping channels, and then you're just like, okay, well, watch this to the end, or at least have it on in the background while I'm doing other stuff. And this was like the first time in a long time I've watched this movie from beginning to end.
Yeah. So did you see anything that you missed the first time, or like what did
takeaways? It was kind of interesting for me. I had an interesting experience watching this. I started the movie and I was like, you know, wow, this is slower than I remember it being. I mean, maybe they just made movies more slowly in 1980. It was a pre-MTV era, but it really doesn't seem to be moving the way I remember. And then I realized I was watching it on the DVD version that I own, and I got
super
was,
extended
DVD. Yes, I have a collector's edition.
Ooh,
it's an expanded version with bonus footage. And then I looked it up on IMDb. The version I was watching last night is 18 minutes longer.
Yeah, I think I watched that version last night too.
The runtime of this is 2 hours and 28 minutes.
Yep.
Which, yeah, that's the one I saw.
Frank, did you watch the extended version?
I can't
version?
Remember. I think mine may have been around 2 hours, so I may not have seen the extended
version. So I looked it up on IMDb, and it lists like all the stuff that's extra, and it was mostly the stuff that I didn't remember.
Like the part where Elwood like quits his job?
Yes.
All right, I did see that.
I have never seen this before. I guess I don't think I've ever watched this DVD that I've owned for probably going on 20 years.
Yeah.
Now, wow. I had never seen or even heard of that scene where Elwood quits his job.
Yeah, because apparently, there's two things that kind of struck me with that one, because, like, you see him without his sunglasses.
Yes, that was which weird. Seems so wrong.
It does, right?
That seems so, because it takes away all the power of the moment where Belushi removes his sunglasses at the end.
Yeah, I didn't even pick up on that. You're right.
Killing that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the only part of that scene that's necessary, I guess, or not necessary, but, like, they show him, like, because he works at a glue factory, and they show him, like, stealing some of the glue, and that's the glue that they use later for the good old boys.
I never even picked that up. I thought that was 70s-style beer. I really thought that was a weird beer can, but I guess late 70s, sure.
I looked it up. It's like, oh, no, those are, like, aerosol
utterly
glue.
Unnecessary. I never once have questioned where Elwood got the glue.
The whole thing falls apart. IO9 articles of the time would have been all about...
And I have never once questioned, hey, what's Elwood Blues' day job? I've never cared about that.
Yeah.
There's so many hot takes if this movie were out now. Yeah, they'd be like, we don't even know Elwood's day job. What's going on?
Yeah, and
what's wrong with you, Russo brothers? Explain it. The Russo brothers would have directed this if it was out now.
Did they have a 401k, or what is going on
and,
there?
Like, the glue thing, it strikes me as, like, there was something, there was another scene that was, that Aykroyd had written that John Landis cut out. And I think rightfully so, where they're talking about the Bluesmobile, and at one point early in the film, he parks the Bluesmobile near, like, this power station thing.
Right, right.
Like, and that's somehow
a transformer or something.
Yeah, and it somehow explains, it's supposed to explain that the Bluesmobile got supercharged, and that enabled it to do all the super feats we see in the movie.
So much better without that.
And John Landis was like, no, it's just a magic car. That's all you need.
And
in the scene, I watched this scene in the movie last night. There's no dialogue or anything. You don't even see, like, sparks flying to the car or anything like that. It's just he parks it. They get out. They walk out of the car. And that's it. And somehow we're supposed to divine that's the reason. I'm sure it made sense in Dan Aykroyd's mind. But
there was an earlier version, and just to get off topic a little bit, of Groundhog Day, where there was a scene, I believe,
voodoo?
Yeah, somebody curses Bill Murray's character to live his life over and over again. Think how much worse that movie would be if there was some magical thing, if a gypsy curse, which I think it may have been a voodoo or gypsy curse.
It was something like that,
made him.
It was some woman he scorned.
Over. Yeah. Think of how horrible that it removes all the
tension, all the mystery,
all the magic. Weirdly enough, all the magic from the movie would be erased.
Wow.
Same thing. I think I even saw that. I didn't realize that's what was supposed to be happening with the car, with the transformer on the car. I'm watching this movie. My wife's in there at the very end, going, "What are you watching?" And I'm like, "Blues Brothers." She's like, "Why did that car just flip over?" I'm like, "Blues Brothers."
Yeah,
like,
exactly. That's all you need. I mean, it was like in the movie Big. Like, that came out at the tail end of all these other body switching movies, where, like, the adult becomes a kid and the kid becomes an adult. And usually there's some convoluted mechanism in place to explain how this happens. And in the movie Big, he makes a wish on a Zoltar machine, and they don't explain it any more than that. They don't explain where the Zoltar machine came from, why this happened to this particular kid or at this particular time. That's all you need to know. Just make the kid into an adult and then just get to the good stuff.
Yeah.
That's
all
you need.
Absolutely. Well, John Landis was very right to make that change.
But then he puts it back in the movie later, and I don't get why he did that.
I think so that you could pay more for the extended version.
I guess I was a sucker.
But yeah, like, I was looking at John Landis. He had quite a run in the 80s.
Oh my God, he did. Yeah. I mean, he did Animal House. He did this, Blues Brothers. He did...
An American Werewolf in London.
Oh, yeah?
He did
Trading Places.
Trading Places, Three Amigos, Spies Like Us. Coming to America, he did.
Yeah.
And he directed Michael Jackson's Thriller.
I was about to say, oh, you forgot his most important.
Yeah, the Thriller.
Did he direct the Bad video, too?
I don't believe so. I got to check my notes. But yeah, like, for the 80s, he had quite a run.
Landis is great, yeah. And Landis got this role based on the strength of the one movie you mentioned.
Animal House.
That's when Belushi was getting huge. That's the thing I didn't get as a kid. I'll admit this right now on this SNL podcast.
Whoa.
I did not get Belushi. Because I was too young. I should leave.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're leaving the non-productive network.
I'm unplugging everything right now.
Wait, you can't just Yeah, so like I was too young to have ever actually seen Belushi. What year did Belushi die? It must have been
82.
So like I was like 3 or 4. Like there's no way I could have gotten any of that. Or
sure.
And so as a young kid, I've told how important Belushi is, but that stuff goes, other than like the pratfalls and the physical comedy, mm-hmm. a lot of it goes over your head. It's not until you get into high school where you're like, oh man. Belushi.
Yeah.
So, like, it's weird. Like, watching the movie when you're super young, you're like, okay, this is just one of the two Blues mm-hmm. Brothers.
Right.
Maybe you like the flips. But other than that, it's just for everything else. And then when you get older, you're like, holy crap, this icon of a person.
Yeah.
And this movie hit at right, I think, the zenith of his career.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This was the crowning glory of his career.
At one point, I mean, the Blues Brothers were so popular. Like, Belushi was on the number one television show, SNL. He had the number one movie, which was Animal House, and the number one album, which was, I believe, the first Blues Brothers album, Briefcase Full of Blues.
Wow.
Which,
that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's a pretty incredible feat.
Yeah. And from what I hear, like, John Belushi, he had to kind of be talked into doing the Blues Brothers, right? Because he wasn't a blues fan.
Yeah. This is what I find so interesting. Belushi's from Chicago, which is this big blues town.
Right.
And Aykroyd is from Toronto, right. or I think originally, like, Ottawa. Mm-hmm. And then he went to Toronto for Second City. But he was the blues fanatic who, like, turned Belushi on to the blues.
Belushi was more of a metalhead and he was into, like, punk rock.
Right.
And then, like, Aykroyd was like, you're from Chicago. It's like the birth of the blues. You should be listening to more blues and R&B. That stuff is awesome.
Right. And Belushi said, like, he was getting disenchanted with, like, rock and roll at the time because it was, like, disco's big heyday.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he needed something new to be turned on to.
New wave
was
probably.
The blues were there.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and
that's pretty dope. And like, and how did, so with the Blues Brothers, I guess it started as like they were doing like an opening band for like SNL when like
they were
when,
doing warm up for a few shows.
That's the word, warm
and
up.
And then they made their debut on air on an episode hosted by Carrie Fisher, actually.
Oh,
and
cool.
That was when they opened up the show with Soul Man, their cover of Soul Man by Sam and Dave. And I mean, that's incredible. I believe I put that on one of my top musical moments from SNL when we did our show about that.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And I still think that's a brilliant performance. And, you know, it's kind of funny. The Blues Brothers, they sort of evolved out of a sketch that Belushi hated because they did the bees early in the show.
Bees.
The Killer Bees. And Belushi hated wearing the bee outfit where he's wearing the stripy shirt and they had the floppy antenna on top. And Belushi hated it because he thought it made him look silly. But one time they did a cover of the song King Bee, or maybe it was an original song. I don't even know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But he was like wearing sunglasses in that. And the Blues Brothers kind of evolved out of that.
Huh.
So if they hadn't done that sketch that Belushi hated, maybe the Blues Brothers wouldn't have come to be. Who knows?
Come to be.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Mm. Uh-huh. Let's just smugly enjoy that for a while. Yeah.
Now.
Clever man, Frank Ablawi.
Just smoking, just loving to smug.
Yeah.
Soaking that smug.
Yeah.
All right, so, as far as the movie goes, I mean, it's pretty simple plot. It's basically,
so simple. That's my favorite part. Go on, please.
I mean, the characters are simple characters, not too much depth to them. They're just two guys that really love the blues, and they do some illegal activities from time to time.
I mean, the movie opens with Jake getting out of jail, like you said, and then they go to the orphanage where they grew up.
Yeah, they visit the penguin.
And they visit the penguin, the head nun there, and they discover that the orphanage is due to close due to back taxes.
Right.
And they have to raise $5,000.
Yeah.
It's
going to get sold to the Board of Ed.
Right. And the nun won't let them make it illegally, so they decide to get their old band back together. And then most of the movie is just gathering the band members.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then they win money by
the
end.
And then the misadventures they have, and they put on a big show. And
along the way, they make a lot of enemies. All the police are after them because they get pulled over at one point, and I think Aykroyd had to give him his license. And
it's suspended.
It's suspended. So, like, you know, arrest this man immediately and impound the car.
Yes.
And then, of course, he speeds off and the cops chase after him.
We could even list the enemies they make along. Actually, before we get off
the real victory is the enemies they made along the way.
the recap of this movie is these two people have to go save the orphanage. They raise money to save the orphanage by getting their band back together and putting on a show. That is the most
they're on a mission from God.
Basic concept for a movie. And somehow you get the Blues Brothers out of it. It is a rambling almost a mess of a movie.
It is a good mess.
Yeah.
But particularly the extended cut that I watched. That's even messier.
Even when, like, we're going back and forth a lot, but if you get to the end of the movie, there, Cab Calloway is doing his musical number. They make it just in time.
Yeah. Right.
So they put on the show. It's the audience goes crazy.
Yeah.
They get a contract. That is the end of the movie. That should be
the
end of the movie.
I was watching the movie. Night. I was like, this is the climax. This is the big show. And then I was like, oh, right. There's that massive car chase after this. This isn't the end. There's like a good 20 minutes left in this thing.
Any other version of this movie, it ends with them getting a contract, a recording deal.
And that's never followed up on after that.
Never.
Yeah, it's not,
at all. It's like, you could cut that scene so easily.
And instead of that being the end of the movie, to the movie's genius, it goes on to, like, well, no, they have to cause infinitely more money damages than the $5,000 they owe. That's even genius.
Yeah.
We need $5,000. Let's spend millions. Millions on cities just blowing up buildings and car accidents.
Right.
And it just goes on and on and on. And every time, it's the Peter Griffin trip and hit his knee joke in a way, but like to the nth. Instead of being but for like a full minute, it's 20 minutes of just boom, boom, car accident.
And they set a record for like the number of cars they wrecked.
Yeah, they wrecked 103 cars during this filming.
I can't believe it's only 103.
Yeah, but
seems low.
From what I've read, it was a world record until it got broken by this movie called The Junk Man in 82. They wrecked 150 cars.
Oh.
Then that got broken in 2003 with The Matrix Reloaded, when they wrecked over 300 cars.
I thought they broke their record again in Blues Brothers 2000.
I thought so,
when they
too.
Did that.
Oh, did they?
I thought I read that.
I thought so, but maybe not. Yeah.
I'm going to
check my
facts.
Write a letter and then throw it in the garbage, because we don't care. We're not redoing this episode.
Wow. Shots to snail mail.
Yeah.
Well, in theory, are going to cover Blues Brothers 2000 at some point, so maybe we'll tackle this question again then.
Send that message then.
Oof. Yeah.
But yeah, so it's just an amazing, like, the concept, so simple that they make it so complicated, and it's wonderful. Can we list the enemies they make along the way?
Absolutely. Please. Let's do this. This is going to be fun.
All right. So it's the
cops. The cops. First of all.
There's Stephen Williams from 21 Jump Street.
Oh, yeah, right. That's where.
Whoa.
Yeah. I was thinking he was the second.
Well, that's the first place I knew him from.
I was thinking the second Deep Throat from X-Files.
He was. Oh, wasn't his name X?
Maybe. Yeah, probably not.
Okay. Also he was like Mulder's informant.
So it was the cops, John Candy's character, Mr. Mercer. I guess he was.
Right. Orange Whip. Three Orange Whips right here.
That was improv, right?
That was. Yes. That was.
The guy who left to get the Orange Whips is also improv. Give that guy a raise.
Absolutely.
There's the mystery woman.
Oh, yeah.
Carrie Fisher.
And it's so amazing for me to think this is Carrie Fisher after Star Wars.
Yeah.
Carrie Fisher in this part with not a whole lot of dialogue. She's got like one speech, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
I mean, she just shows up and.
Things that I lost as a child, I forgot that we didn't know who Carrie Fisher was throughout the entire movie.
Like, yeah, no, it's
once you know who she is, like watching it again, you're like, oh, okay, she's trying to get revenge on Jake. But imagine watching this the first time and going, who is this person?
Well, I mean, Aykroyd actually asked this at one point. He, like, I think after the third attempt on their life, he just goes, who is this woman?
Yeah.
And I find that hilarious because
it's understated. It's like she's a mild inconvenience.
Yeah, exactly. It's never commented on either. Yeah.
No.
She blows up the building they're in. They just get up. They brush the bricks off them, and then they go on with their business. They never question why did that happen. Who is this?
How do we survive? None
they just are like, oh yeah, oh no, this is the time of day we get bazooka'd by this woman.
Yeah, it becomes such a cartoon, and like she just. You know, tries to shoot them. She tries to blow them up while they're in a phone booth. The phone booth goes flying up in the air.
Yeah.
She drives off.
Yeah.
And then, like, the phone booth comes crashing down.
I love how the phone booth was right next to a propane tank, by the way.
Yes. That's hilarious. As you do.
Yeah.
And then the phone booth comes crashing down. All the quarters go around. And first thing Elwood says was like, hey, there's like $7 worth of quarters around here. Ooh, we're rich.
Yeah. You were listing the enemies. I'm sorry.
There's the
good old boys.
The good old boys.
Charles Napier. The great Charles Napier.
A rival band, a country music band.
Right.
Like, why?
They play both kinds of music.
Why?
Country and Western.
I love that line. That's a
great line. Yeah, that's a great line.
And the owner of the club, the Bob's country, whatever it was.
Bob's country. I wrote it down.
As I've produced more and more shows, I'm starting to feel more sympathy towards that character. what? Yeah. Yeah, they ran up a bill of $300 worth of beer. No, that's not fair.
Yeah.
No, we thought they were comped at the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, we weren't charged for the first round, so, yeah.
We thought, it's like, all right, let me go back to the band and just get the money. Start the car. Yeah.
He's just writing out the traveler's check on the dash. I'm gonna co-sign it. Don't worry, just stay here. I'm gonna get in the car so I can run.
Explaining the system by which they fill out checks.
Yes.
Then the I think the final villain, the most I guess the one that ages the best and the worst, the Illinois Nazis.
Henry Ooh. Gibson.
Oh my
God. I was like, I remember when these scenes played as satire.
Yeah.
Remember when
they were absurdist.
Remember,
at the time.
Nazis were like a thing in the distant past in 1980.
Remember when we all agreed Nazis were bad? Remember that?
The multicultural crowd that was booing the Nazis. Because they were still people who would protest occasionally, but they were lunatics,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, wow, this takes me back to a better time.
Yeah.
But, you know, amazingly enough, there's like a throwaway line of dialogue in the Illinois Nazis first scene where they say, like, oh, they won their court case and they won the right to demonstrate.
Yeah.
That was actually based on a real court case in Illinois. So that was actually sort of an in-joke. I'm trying to...
Yeah, it's not
it,
as
it
if...
It wasn't that. It was like 1977, something like that.
Yes.
So
Nazis and you know, the KKK and a bunch of these groups that, you know, do... They win court cases so they could demonstrate and people come and boo them. The Baptist Church people. Westboro Baptist Church.
Yeah.
So if you're a regular Baptist, write a letter to us, but don't mail it.
Yeah.
Those people have always been an issue, but they've never been this powerful.
Yeah.
And in this case, it's just. When Jake and Elwood drove into the Nazis, I'm like, you know what?
And run them off the bridge.
Yeah,
they all dive off the bridge.
This is way too topical.
Yeah.
1980s movie.
I found the reference on the IMDb trivia, and it was actually a case in Skokie, Illinois, where the National Socialist Nazi Party of America planned a public demonstration, and Skokie is apparently a heavy Jewish population, and had... At that time, a large number of Holocaust survivors.
Wow.
After the local governments provided various impediments to the Nazis' march, they eventually took the matter to the Supreme Court, which led to a 1977 decision, Socialist Party of America versus Village of Skokie, in favor of the Nazis' First Amendment right to freedom of assembly. Mm. The group subsequently did hold several Nazi rallies, but in Chicago instead of Skokie. So they were actually...
This
commenting on a fairly topical event
at
the time this movie was written and shot. So I did not know that.
The more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah.
And by the way, the name of the Nazi group.
Oh, right.
I don't remember the exact name. Do you have it,
Darren? American Socialist White People's Party, which the acronym, ASWPP. Which is
asswipe.
It spells that asswipe.
That's
which
amazing.
Never commented on.
That
but
is
just
amazing.
A nice subtle.
Oh
thing.
My god, that's so good.
That's great.
That's
so,
quality writing.
Kudos to you, 1970s Dan Aykroyd, for showing the Nazis what for.
Brief aside, 1970s Dan Aykroyd, hot.
He
was a handsome man.
Engaged to Carrie Fisher.
Yeah. Well, all right.
John Belushi fixed them up.
Oh my god.
He said that. Belushi like came over to Aykroyd's apartment with Carrie Fisher and then passed out on the couch. He said this was Belushi's version of a blind date. So the two of them, and they eventually got married or got engaged. They didn't ever get married. Right. But
well done, Belushi. Way to look out for your bro.
Nice.
Yeah,
nice.
I'll just bring a woman to your house and pass out.
Yeah, that's good.
It's like smooth. It's a modern day Cupid.
Yeah, exactly.
And there are all sorts of fun stories about they were desperately trying to keep Belushi clean during the shooting of this movie. And like Carrie Fisher was one of the people trying to keep Belushi clean.
Yeah.
Now, when you have 1980 Carrie Fisher trying to get you to stop using cocaine, you perhaps are using too much cocaine.
That's quite a bit.
that's a wake-up call right there. Where Carrie Fisher's like, yeah, maybe you should scale it back a little bit.
But then again, I heard that like Aykroyd said that cocaine was... Everybody was kind of all coked up, and like so much so that it was included in the budget.
Right, they were doing a lot of night shoots, and the cocaine helped them stay up all night.
I don't have the records on this, but I'm relatively certain that at one point, cocaine was questionable whether it was addicting. because I guess biologically, I don't know whatever the reason, and was socially much more acceptable,
right?
In like the late 70s, yeah, and what have you. Early.
Well, I mean, Belushi's death really turned a lot of people around on that. I was skimming through the Live from New York book this morning to look for little bits of trivia we could include on this episode, and Tom Davis was saying that after Belushi died, I mean, a lot of people just stopped using drugs like cold turkey after that. And Tom Davis was saying, like, I couldn't smoke grass openly anymore, like in the offices or anything.
Wow.
It was just frowned on. Like, so many people, because Belushi's death just really scared a lot of people. Like, they didn't realize that drugs could be that serious, that fatal. But
that's another thing you don't think. Like, doesn't, like, we never realized drugs would be bad for us. Drugs are supposed to fix everything.
I mean, I'm amazed that after this movie, they had enough cocaine left to have the
1980s. Yeah,
I don't understand how there was enough left over.
Where'd all the cocaine go? We're out of cocaine.
Yeah.
All right. I guess we should also talk about like all the musical performances. I mean,
if we must.
Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, dude,
they make up 90% of the movie.
This movie has. This movie had James Brown, it had Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, John Lee Hooker.
In speaking roles for the most part.
Yeah.
All those people.
Cab Calloway. And and you see Chaka Khan in there for a little bit. I mean, this had...
Where's Chaka Khan?
She's in the choir. When James Brown is... James Brown plays a...
The preacher,
Reverend Cleophas, I believe his name is.
Yes.
And,
great name.
You see Chaka Khan is like the lead choir singer.
Interesting. Yeah. I did not realize that was Chaka Khan.
This is not a period of time where like mainstream audiences would know most of these singers. I mean, it depends what you mean by mainstream. So this is like a very British film. Yeah, white.
Yeah. Effectively. So, like, it means white.
Yeah. At that point, especially. So you've got a bunch of people who are stars in their own genre, but no one believes, or no one who's making these movies believes they can front a major motion picture, right? You don't give a speaking role to Aretha Franklin.
You probably
don't even put Aretha Franklin in a movie.
Yeah. It would not have been made if Aykroyd and Belushi didn't happen to be bankable at that time,
right,
and they were at the top of their popularity. If you wanted to make the same movie without these guys in the lead, it would not be made, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. And even at the time with these stars, they were arguing, they were saying, put in more recent R&B stars.
Yeah.
Right.
As opposed to people who had their like big hits maybe decades earlier.
Yeah, they'd be like opening like Donna Summer or something like that.
Yeah,
right.
All disco kind of people.
Yeah, very much so.
There's an interesting story. When Cab Calloway came in to record a new version of Minnie the Moocher for the movie, he was disappointed because he had apparently just cut a disco version.
Oh.
And he was like, oh, we're not going to do that? We're not going to do the disco version? This is like what I did 5 decades ago.
Yeah.
And they were like, yeah, that's what we want. But apparently Cab Calloway had recut Minnie the Moocher for every like musical trend in the decades
good
since.
For him.
So there's like a new wave version of Minnie the Moocher?
I don't know.
It's still happening somehow.
I haven't looked up the disco version of Minnie the Moocher. I don't know if it's out there somewhere on the interwebs, but...
There's like a techno house mix version. I hope
it boggles the mind.
Oh, oh my god, that's awesome.
If there's a dubstep version of Minnie the Moocher out there, please let us know, listeners.
Yeah.
I'm sure there is. There's gotta be. Oh, that's so good.
Yeah. Oh, and I also read Little Richard was asked to be in this movie, but he turned it down because I think at the time he was doing mostly gospel music.
Right, I read that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we could have had Little Richard in this thing, that's a bummer.
Amazing. And interestingly, like a lot of the people they had in the movie, they weren't experienced with lip syncing to pre-recorded tracks, which they commonly do in movie musicals. You record the music first and then you lip sync it on the set when you're to the pre-recorded track, so you're not throwing out your voice. But like Aretha Franklin and James Brown, they would sing the song a different way every time they sang it.
Right.
And so with Aretha, they had to really kind of reconstruct the think number around where she just kind of matched the track for her lip sync.
You can kind of see that.
Like she's not like matching it a whole lot. And James Brown, they actually had him sing live to a pre-recorded backing track. Like the choir is lip syncing, but James Brown is singing it live.
Wow.
Because that's how he did it. And John Lee Hooker, of course, they captured live.
Yeah.
So...
I think my friend Rick said at the time, he was like, this is a movie where they cast singers in acting roles and you can tell.
Yeah.
But it's still charming. It's still great.
Everyone in the Blues Brothers band is a real musician.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
and Donald Duck Dunn.
You can tell, like, they're so slightly, they range from completely awkward to slightly awkward, and it somehow makes the movie better.
Yeah, but that's very true.
Some of them are good. I like, I'm forgetting which one it was. I think it was Alan who plays the maitre d' at the Snooty restaurant.
Oh, yeah.
He's a good
Murphy.
He was good.
Comic actor.
Piano was good.
You know, I mean, I love his read where he the Blues Brothers come in and he just goes, "Oh my God, you're out already? I thought it was 5 years. Didn't they say it was 5 years?
They said it was 5 years.
It was actually pretty good. Oh, and also in that restaurant scene, you see Paul Rubens.
Oh, that's right, as the waiter. Right.
Yeah,
yes. A lot of weird.
A young Paul Rubens, pre Pee Wee Herman.
Yeah. There's a lot of interesting casting that happened in this movie just for extras. Steven Spielberg.
Oh, yeah, Spielberg.
As the tax assessor guy.
And I was like, why?
The same time Spielberg was doing 1941 with Belushi and Aykroyd, and I think Carrie Fisher's in that, too. And apparently John Landis has a cameo in that movie, but nobody remembers that because 1941.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ooh. Should we review that?
No.
Okay. All right, done.
Yeah, it's...
I've never seen it, but I've heard stories.
I've seen it once, and it is not good.
Oh.
It could be interesting to watch in detail all the ways that it's not good, but...
Maybe not.
So we're going to watch a lot of bad movies, my friend.
Yeah. I'm not looking forward to that. It's bad.
What are your favorite parts about this movie? Like, what is it that makes this movie good? I'm assuming we like it. Because
absolutely.
I don't think we've said
how much for the girl? Yet. How much for the little girl? Sell me your children.
There are so
I
many
I love
quotable,
that moment so much.
Oh, my God.
That's
so
one
many
my
good quotable moments.
Yeah.
And that's not even one of the high quotable moments, I think, for good reason. Sell me your children.
I like that one.
I love it. Because that's literally the first thing he says to that family. Yeah. How much for the girl? How much for the little girl?
Yeah.
Sell me your children.
I like his reasoning for not calling the police, even though that is definitely what they should have done.
Right.
You can't call the police. I'm out on bail. No, I'm
out on parole.
I'm like, well, that's why you should be afraid. Yeah. That's not why he should have called.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense now. I think about it. But
yeah,
I did like that one line where Elle would take Jake back to his his small little apartment. It's like some. It's like some hotel for
right men. By the L train.
Right by the L. Oh, that's another thing that I noticed too. Like whenever you see Elwood's, like his window is visible in the shot, a train goes by it.
Right.
Like a train's constantly going by.
And I think
by.
He actually said, Jake says, like, oh, how often does a train go by? Yeah. And it's like, oh, so often you'll never notice it.
Exactly. I love that line. It's like, so often you'll never notice it.
Yeah.
I mean, I love that scene. And of course, I mean, maybe talk about this. There's a car chase scene in a mall.
Yeah.
Drive the car through a mall.
Yeah.
That scene gets better with time because as it goes on, you're like, wow, Pier 1. That's what it's logo used to look
like. Yeah, they're like, Pier 1 Imports.
And it was actually a closed mall.
Yes, it was the, I wrote it down. Dixie Square Mall in Harvey, Illinois.
That's okay. Right. It was a closed mall. They actually basically restored these stores.
Right.
And they were told, like, oh, you can crash into this store, you can crash into this store. And I think there were other stores they had to leave alone. To fill the parking lot, it was all new cars, because that was the only way they could fill the parking lot. And the stuntmen were told, don't crash into any of these cars, because they're new.
Wow.
And, yeah, and they had to fill all these stores with merchandise. Whatever wasn't ruined, they sent back to the manufacturers. They had to get guards to guard the merchandise overnight.
Wow.
So people wouldn't steal it. They discovered that those guards were stealing some of the merchandise.
Oh.
They hired another set of guards to guard those guards.
They needed guards to guard the guards.
Exactly.
The movie seems low budget because of how rough around the edges it is.
I think it was $27 million, something like that.
It was like one of the most expensive comedies ever made at the time.
It was. Yeah, it spent a ton of money. I think.
We should look up how much that is.
I think the budget was like $27 million.
Okay. Let me get another tab going, and then I'll
confirm.
Well, I want to figure out how much that is in today's money.
Yes.
So, okay.
But there's just like, because of the acting from the musicians, because of the rambling, non-coherent plot at times, because of the lack of payoff for things, which it seems like it's a amateurish attempt at a movie, but instead it's just like this absurdist genius movie. I think
what's one of your favorite lines?
My favorite line is probably it's however many miles to Chicago, and it's dark, we're in sunglasses,
miles to Chicago.
Right?
Yeah.
That's great, it's iconic, and there are millions of great lines in the movie. But my favorite thing about the movie, having watched it all the way through just last night again, is how absurd everything is, yet still how much of it tracks, how much of it makes sense, even though it is insane.
Yeah. There is a logic to it.
Yeah, so like, Carrie Fisher, for example, they never explain who she is throughout the entire movie.
Yeah, until like the very end.
Until the very end.
They don't even give a character a name. She doesn't have a name.
No.
No, she's like the woman
The girl that Jake left at the altar. Right. And then he has this very quotable line of dialogue with her. They look at each other's eyes. They hug and kiss. He drops her in the mud and leaves.
Yeah, it's like, all right, let's go.
They're so, like, that shouldn't have stopped her. Mm-hmm. But it does, because that resolves her scene. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
All the police officers who finally cornered the Blues Brothers in the music hall decide, you know, I've never heard these guys sing. Let's let them perform.
Cool whip.
It's like, yeah, why? Yeah. Great that you did it. Yeah. Perfect decision. But why?
Yeah.
It does work. The country music, why did the band chase them down? The band didn't do...
They were screwed out of a gig.
I guess they were screwed out of a gig, yeah.
And they sabotaged their
RV
vehicle. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's after they had already been committed to going to there and just staring and pointing at them while they're performing.
Yeah.
I'm like, what's happening here?
Yeah.
It's beautiful because all these ridiculous moments add up to something that's like, yeah, that makes sense. Even when for some reason they're going off that bridge, the unbuilt bridge with the Nazis following them.
Right.
One Nazi backs off and decides not to do the bridge. They go a different way, and then the Blues Brothers hang over the cliff, then somehow reverse back, flip over.
That never made sense.
Never makes sense.
Oh, the physics of it are we're in a total cartoon physics world at that point.
Gibson and Nazi's vehicle is flying hundreds of feet in the air. Yeah.
They literally dropped that car from a helicopter. And they had to get like a dispensation or approval from the FAA.
Of course.
To do that. Because they're dropping it over Chicago.
Oh, you can't just do that?
Interestingly enough, if you had told me that was a Matchbox car and a special effect, I would have believed it. So good for them.
Real car. Why didn't they do that?
By the way, I just went on an inflation calculator site. The $27 million that the movie cost in today's 2019 would cost $83,735,388.35. So, expensive movie.
Yeah.
I would say so.
The building crashes into the pavement, and then for some reason, the other Nazi car that had left minutes ago falls into the same hole. Why? Because good. Good resolution.
Because they were done with the Nazis. Yeah.
And it was the whole movie for me.
And
it's
literally the last we see of the Nazis.
Yeah.
It's brilliant because it doesn't have to do any of the things it does. It just chooses to. And it works. Cab Calloway changes costume in the middle of his song.
Oh, yeah.
He flips back. He's back into his original outfit.
Right.
My wife, who had seen it, just stepped in. Like, she was in and out. She was like, why did he change? I'm like, because he's Cab Calloway.
It's magic.
It was just a neat, surreal touch. I mean, I like that. I enjoyed that.
I loved it.
That's great.
So good. It was such the choices they made, it's somehow they made all the right choices.
Yeah. I think that once they decided to just sort of go with that tone of just like, not to explain too much of like all the odd thing that can't be explained.
Yeah.
That, like,
it's the Blues Brothers world.
That's just how things
work there.
Yeah, this just happened, and hopefully you'll find it charming enough to, you know, overlook it, let it go.
Yep.
Like, yeah, a car can backflip over another car while a car full of Nazis jump off a cliff, and the Nazis tell each other, I've always loved you.
Yeah.
I just thought of another couple favorite lines for the movie. Mm. When they go into the restaurant that...
Shea Paul, the fancy restaurant.
That Matt Murphy is running with Aretha Franklin.
Oh, the soul food place.
The soul food place. And Dan Aykroyd, Elwood, he just orders plain white toast.
Yes.
And then Jake orders 4 fried chickens and a Coke. And she says, do you want wings or legs? And he says, no. 4 fried chickens and a Coke. Which I can totally see John Belushi
eating.
That
is his signature meal, because Murphy's like, Elwood.
Yeah, Jake Elwood.
He knows them from
he
the
knows
orders.
Their signature beats.
Exactly.
It's like, there are two guys out here look like a scenic...
scenic diamond merchants. Very specific. And I'm like, yeah, all right. Also tracks. And it all tracks so well.
It all tracks.
Yeah. And I love that they just like sit there at the counter just grimly watching during the think number. And then they just join in dancing for like a verse. And then they go back to the counter and just sit there solemnly again.
Yeah. And it doesn't make sense, and it does make sense, and it's great.
What is your favorite musical number in the movie? Oh. Do you have one? If you had to pick one,
jeepers. I mean, I do like the closing number where they get together and they sing. What is it?
Give me Jailhouse Rock.
Jailhouse Rock was good too, but the one at the palace where Steve Lawrence put them up.
Yes,
they're the promoter. Where they sing "Somebody to Love" and "Sweet Home Chicago." I dug that performance quite a bit. And you know, I'll say the Ray Charles performance, the "Shake a Tail Feather," where people
that's a good one.
People are just suddenly dancing in the streets.
Yep.
Like out of
nowhere. Even the little girl. There's this adorable little girl who's doing the...
Yeah, the Ray Charles blind jokes. The two. Yeah. The one he opens fire on the kid who's going to shoplift.
Yeah. Right.
And the one
out of nowhere.
Dude, he puts the poster back upside down.
He put the poster upside down.
Yeah. Like,
pick a joke to make with this blind guy.
Yeah. Can he see or can he not?
Like he somehow knows when a kid is about to steal a guitar.
Right.
And shoot at a child, apparently. But
right.
He put
and not hit the guitar.
Yeah, not hit the guitar either.
Or the kid. Or
yeah, but he also puts up posters upside down because he's blind.
Yeah.
What about you? What's one of your favorite performances there?
That's a tough one. I don't know if I have an answer. Frank, do you?
I think Minnie the Moocher is probably my favorite. Okay. Cab Calloway is one of my favorites.
That's a good one.
I like every different version of that song is amazing. I did find a dubstep version, by the way.
Oh, what? Wow. When? Just now?
Just now on the phone. I could play it if we dare. I have not heard it, but I'm sure it's amazing.
Should we include that at the end of the podcast?
We might have to. We legally have to.
Oh, boy.
I would say Minnie the Moocher is probably my favorite. Think is close. Think is really good. Yeah.
Think is probably it for me.
Yeah.
I think that's it. I also love their covers of She Caught the Katie and the Peter Gunn theme.
Of course.
The Peter Gunn theme is just one of the best pieces of music ever written.
I mean,
it's just... You immediately feel cool when you hear that song. Just that bass line.
I want that music played anytime I'm walking down the street or driving. Or just anywhere, like walking to a... Into a laundromat or something.
It's the Jaws theme.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's really good. It's great.
And I'll give a tip of the hat to the when they're playing at the country place, the Bob's Country Bunker, and they're doing Rawhide.
The theme from Rawhide.
Yeah, because
get them up, move them up.
Yeah, because they're trying to do some give me some love, and in the country people are not having it, and
Lord.
They throw beer bottles at them while they're behind chicken wire.
Right.
You're not doing justice to that scene because they first see the chicken wire and they're like, chicken wire. And immediately the band's like, oh, no. They perform a blues song and the audience doesn't like it. They throw bottles of beer at them.
Right.
They switch up to country music. And in celebration, the audience throws bottles of beer at them.
To show their approval.
It's literally the same thing. And I'm watching this going, this is amazing. This is just amazing. It cues the same thing. The bottles of beer being chucked at the chicken.
Either way, you're getting bottles of beer thrown at you.
It's just joy or sadness. That's how they express themselves.
You see them having an ominous feeling from the chicken wire. I always took that as just confusion. They didn't get why there was chicken wire there.
Possibly.
But like Jake is like such like a slick talker. He's like, that's just a normal thing. Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
we'll just set up. We'll be fine. And then, of course, they do Give Me Some Love, and they get beer bottles thrown at them and booze. And then they do Rawhide, and then they get beer bottles thrown at them.
And they do Stand By Your Man.
Stand By Your Man.
Which, apparently, those are the only two country songs they know.
I guess.
Because it ends with Rawhide.
They end with Rawhide. So they were presumably just playing Rawhide over and over
that's
night.
That's the same. That's what I read for years. I don't know about that. It could be that there was other songs in there, and they just closed
out. I like the idea that they are constantly playing Rawhide.
And everybody was just as happy.
And the owners is fine with that.
Yeah, it's like, they're doing it on a loop. That's cool.
We play both kinds, country and western. That's another great line.
I like that line.
That's another great line.
How much beer do you think they drank to make up $300 worth of beer?
In 1980 money? How much was a beer in 1980? Yeah, I don't know.
Like I would say a bottle's like probably $4, $3.
Oh, I don't think so.
I mean, it's a cheap beer.
I think much less. I think
it like would be buck. Like $2 or under.
Yeah.
Really?
I think. Yeah, in 1980?
If you know how much a beer cost in Illinois in 1980, write us a letter.
Yeah, tweet at us.
Anyone who was of drinking age in 1980, or even if you weren't, if you were an underage drinker,
send us
going
a
to the bars.
Send us a self-addressed stamped envelope with your social security number. Yeah. Read it on the air.
Yeah, your ATM pin, all that stuff.
There was a line I missed that's like kind of a subtle joke, sort of a subtle SNL reference, and I don't know if this is in the theatrical cut or this is just in the extended cut that I was unknowingly watching, but when they're all in the sauna with Steve Lawrence,
yes,
and they tell him we need $5,000, and Steve Lawrence says $5,000. What do you think you are, the Beatles? And I remembered, isn't that like the amount that they offered the Beatles on SNL, or was it like $3,000 or something
like that?
Okay, I was thinking it was a reference to that famous Lorne Michaels offer
he
made on the show, but I didn't look up that sketch.
I didn't think of it. No, I'm pretty sure it was like $3,000.
Okay, if the amount is different, then I'm the dumbass. But
Trumbull.
Okay,
but Trumbull is a dumbass. Send us a letter.
send us a letter regardless.
But I love the gag at the end where like for that whole scene, you think it's just Steve Lawrence talking to Jake and Elwood, and then at the end, he's just like, "Come on, guys, let's go!" And then like all eight band members, are in towels. And they just get up and leave.
And even while they're in a sauna, Jake and Elwood, they don't take off their hats or their sunglasses.
Nope.
Just hat, sunglasses, towel around the waist.
Yep, that's the beauty of it.
Wow. I mean, of course, that probably makes it even more powerful at the end where, you know, when Jake
removes the glasses.
The sunglasses. Like that's the first and only time he's seen without the sunglasses.
That scene with Elwood quitting his job, I had to fast forward through it. I was like, this is so wrong. I cannot support this as a consumer.
That should have been cut or remade.
And it's so early in the movie, too. And it's just like, you can't kill the mystique that early.
Yeah, you don't see Jake until he gets his glasses on.
No, and you never see Elwood's eyes in the theatrical cut.
Yeah.
It's just so wrong.
Yeah, it was a good move to cut that scene out.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everybody needs an editor. And like so often, I used to really like director's cuts and seeing deleted scenes and stuff like that. But now it's like, usually that stuff was cut for a reason. And everybody needs an editor.
Yeah, I think there are very special exceptions where you're like, I would like to see what the original artist intended because there was so much meddling.
Yeah,
right. But I mean, if there wasn't really, and there is, I don't know how much meddling they did not keep them on budget.
So
I'm not sure if there was that much meddling. Yeah,
supposedly like an executive came to the set because they started shooting, I think, before they had a budget, and somebody was like, "Oh, the budget's like $17 million," and John Landis was like, "I think we've spent that already."
Sounds about right.
Yeah, we're gonna need. We're going to need a bigger budget.
There is no reason for a Blues Brothers movie to be nearly 2.5 hours.
No. It works. They use every bit of
every part of the final, buffalo?
Yeah, basically. The moment, the one of the climaxes of the movie when they're all trying to pay the taxes, which is a scene that you may arguably don't even need, right? They could just say, we have the $5,000. We're
right.
good.
Yeah. Right,
end
right.
movie. But they have, they barricade a door. Well, they go through the entire city, cause lots of amazing damage and beautiful damage.
Yeah, so I mean, at this point, like literally, they have like the army and the National Guard after
everyone.
The Blues Brothers. Like, the cops, they have helicopters.
And arguably, if the police had done any amount of police work, they would have been like, all right, they're going to go to the tax assessor's office. We're going to arrest them there.
Right.
But no, every available police officer driving at the same time at the same speed.
And they have a dispatcher saying something like the use of excessive violence to take down the Blues Brothers has been approved.
Yes. Yeah. How can you approve unnecessary violence?
Yeah.
Then it becomes necessary. It's beautiful. So they barricade one door. Then they keep going. Ask for directions. Barricade another door. Keep going. Barricade a third. By the third door is barricading the scene.
It's literally like a wastebasket in front of the door. And two chairs, and then a bench on top of the two chairs. And the it's the worst barricade ever.
And it's the third in a row.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why are
this
we
would delay
this
someone
time?
For like maybe 2 seconds.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they get to the door, and there's a sign saying, I'll be back in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's just them just waiting while fucking like the entire city of Chicago is after them.
And it's Steven Spielberg eating his lunch, and he's like, oh, do you need some help? And they say in the movie, they're going to the tax assessor's office right when they open. So they're going at like presumably 9 a.m.
Yeah.
And
this guy's
eating. But Spielberg's broken for lunch.
That should be breakfast, if you think about it. Yeah, and like even there's like when the everybody comes after them, there's like there's a fire truck there. There's like firemen and busting down the door with axes.
I love the policemen. They stop at the information desk and they're like, "Excuse me, did two men like dressed in dark suits and sunglasses come by here and ask for directions?" And he's like, "Yeah, I sent them that way. Thank you." And then they all go screaming off.
Just an angry mob.
I like the huts when they're rappelling down the side of the building, and it's kind of like atonal. There's like two of them, so there's like hut. It's like very quiet, reserved, and then the camera widens the shot. And you get hut. Yeah.
It's like three or four of
it's
them.
It's just ridiculous. So I do have a question.
Sagittarius.
That might happen for the rest of for your summer series of doing the SNL movies.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to turn a sketch into a feature-length movie.
Right.
And
right.
This is a weird sketch to begin with, this musical sketch, this musical comedy sketch, which is basically just them singing
and
maybe absurdist costumes.
Because it's not like they establish anything about their personas or their personal histories or anything like that
the
on the show.
Songs aren't even joke songs, right? Like that happen later on in
SNL singing. They're genuinely singing these songs.
At most, it's their performance is ridiculous, and these are two white comedians we know, so that's the funny thing, maybe. Mm-hmm. How does this movie, perhaps the first theatrical SNL movie, how does this deliver on the transition between sketch to film?
Well, I mean, it certainly develops them as characters. We have personalities for both Jake and Elwood, and it gives them a personal history. We know they come from the orphanage. They learned a love of the blues from Curtis, who is... Did they say what his position
was? He was the janitor.
He was the janitor.
Like the janitor, yeah.
Who's Cab Calloway's character, who dresses the same as the Blues Brothers. So that's where they got their look from, too, presumably. But I like that it doesn't give you more than you need to know about them. You
don't they give the characters some personality. You see, like, Jake is like the fast-talking, you know, shyster one. Elwood's a little bit more quiet, but he's also, like, he knows more, like, technical stuff. Like, he's a bit more savvy when it comes to, like, you know,
he's
cars.
But
character.
I mean,
it doesn't
like tell us things we don't need to know. We never find out like why Jake is in jail at the beginning of the movie.
You get an idea. Yeah, he was robbing some place. They do pay for the comedians.
Yeah. They said like he was robbing like a gas station to pay for the band.
Okay, so I'm a dumbass like again. In the theatrical cut, we don't find out about Elwood's day job, which still such a fucking stupid choice. I can't get over that.
You don't even need that, really.
No, you don't need that.
Yeah, it's smooth. I think there's moments that are very, like, it recreates the sketch often. Every time there's a musical number, it's that sketch again.
Right.
It's the SNL sketch.
And they come out the way they did it on SNL and in their live shows where Elwood has the briefcase handcuffed to his wrist and Jake comes out. He's twirling the key. They unlock the handcuffs and they open up the briefcase and they take it Elwood's harmonica and then that you know that's the harmonica he uses during the show. It's a great bit.
Awesome. Yeah. I think it's a lot like Wayne's World. I think if you do Wayne's World eventually,
That's our next one.
There's a similarity in which case Wayne's World is the bit is these people on a public television being weird, right?
And putting on a not so great show,
right? And the movie is about how these people are doing that, how they're putting on their...
What happens to them off air.
Yeah. Right. How do they put their sketches on? What happens? What connects the two? And then maybe they have a chance for greatness because they get like a real TV show.
Right.
Yeah. And it kind of links it all together, but it still gives you that sketch every few minutes in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think this does that as well. It's one of the better SNL movies because it does deliver that. This is the sketch, musical numbers, and we're just stringing them all together with... exposition, which is barely exposition.
I agree with that. I really dug this movie quite a bit.
It is fun.
We didn't even mention also Twiggy makes an appearance.
Twiggy blew my mind as a kid. That was the most confusing thing about the movie, I think. Even more so. So
how did Twiggy blow your mind?
I did not, because so she was credited as Twiggy, and I had no idea what Twiggy meant.
Right.
Or why she had a role in the movie.
Is she in this and in Caddyshack? I don't... like, was Twiggy such
a big
thing?
She was huge.
She was like a model, right?
Huge, I think, English model.
Yeah, okay. She was a big deal for
in the pre-internet age, you don't just look this stuff up. You have to know...
Right.
Or you just don't know. So, like, I had no context of who this person is, but the movie does. The movie is just like, hey, guys, we got Twiggy. And I'm like, what's a Twiggy?
Yeah.
What's that... confused the hell out of me as a kid. It wasn't until I was much older that I was like, oh, this is a reference I didn't get at the time.
Right.
Now I understand.
She's just a supermodel. All right.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. I guess that's it. I guess we should.
Would you recommend it?
Absolutely.
I would, but with the qualification that you get this theatrical cut. There's no reason to see these extra 18 minutes.
Yeah.
That they were rightfully cut and they should have been left in a vault.
Absolutely. I mean, even if you're not familiar with the Blues Brothers from the SNL show.
Still works.
I think it still works.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
You just like kind of watching. It's like, oh, okay, I guess there's these two guys. They're really into the blues and just go on. It's never boring.
Yeah.
It's always enjoyable. Even though it does kind of move a little bit slow at some paces. They take their time with a little bit. But honestly, once it kicks in, it really kicks in. I mean,
it's just
car chase
through
a wall. How can that be boring?
And, I mean, Belushi and Aykroyd have such a great chemistry together, just both a comedic chemistry and a personal chemistry. You can tell they were real friends, real tight in real life. It's just fun. And their charisma kind of carries you through the movie, even during what you might consider some of the slow parts or something.
Yeah, I think like Darren said earlier, it's like it's a rite of passage movie. You have to watch it if you are into this kind of comedy.
Yeah.
Then it's something you definitely want to put under your belt at some point. My fear is modern kids who aren't going to make it to this point in the podcast anyways may watch this and be like, I don't get any of it.
You're dumb kids.
Yeah, but
Frank doesn't like
awful.
You.
Yeah.
Awful. If you're a dumb kid, try to like, I don't know, send me a Snapchat or something.
Yeah.
Bastards.
Yeah, it's a Vine tweet or whatever. And it's a Snapper chat.
So. You're dumb.
Go
Instagram your feelings.
Unless you have expendable income and then back our Patreon at patreon.com.
Oh, yeah. No, we'll still take your money.
We're good.
No, we are shameless whores.
Yes. Find us on Vimeo.
Non-productive.com, kids.
Yeah. Indeed.
Hit us up.
And listen to our other fine shows as well.
Yeah, don't do that. That's
not well, I didn't say that.
No, I really don't think
okay.
it's worth it.
Yeah, well, they're not very good, but we wanted to throw out a modicum of support.
Hey, guys, thanks for having me on. This was
absolutely
a lot of fun. Yeah, I can't commit to like a weekly SNL thing because I'm not allowed to watch TV on Saturday night.
Okay.
That's when my church meets. But
amen.
No, we don't say that.
Oh, Jesus. All right, I'm sorry.
We definitely don't say that one. No. But it's nice to see a movie with you guys because it's fun to talk about classic comedy. And please invite me back when you do It's Pat.
Okay. Have you seen It's Pat before?
I have, and I don't remember most of it, and I'll watch it again. And
I have never seen It's Pat. I have no idea where it's available.
I'll get a copy for you guys. There is
really?
Yeah. There is
that a promise or a threat?
Probably both. Okay. I actually do believe it probably picks up more. It's a little bit better now, but maybe worse. It may be worse in 2018.
I'm thinking the central joke behind It's Pat will not play well now.
I think maybe they're a little bit, because they tend to be more sensitive when they make the movie version. They address that.
Yeah.
There is one joke.
Because I know Pat has has a love interest who's also sort of ambiguous gender.
Yes.
Exactly.
Played by Dave Foley from Kids in the Hall.
Yeah.
Oh, is that who it
believe?
Was? Yeah.
Played Chris.
Yeah.
There is one, I don't even know if I want to spoil. We're not going to talk about it, but if I bring it up, if I find it, then I will make you watch it on VHS.
Yeah, that is something to look forward to.
I haven't seen it either. Maybe. And I was like, I know it's just like streaming somewhere, but you got like pay to rent. And I was like, do I really want to pay for this?
I'm not going to pay for any of these movies if I don't have to.
Well,
since you bought that DVD 20 years ago.
Yeah, well, I mean, Blues Brothers was a movie I liked, so, I mean, most of these movies, as I realized last week, I have not seen.
Yeah, this is all going to be new for you.
I have seen Wayne's World, I've never seen the Coneheads movie, don't think I've seen all of Wayne's World 2, definitely haven't seen It's Pat, Stuart Saves His Family, seen bits of Blues Brothers 2000, I have not seen A Night at the Roxbury, although there were some stories that broke about A Night at the Roxbury.
Oh, that episode. When we when we review that, we're going
to... Yeah, we'll talk about that.
We're going to tell some tales out of
Superstar
school.
I've not seen. Ladies Man I've seen bits of, I think.
And, Ladies Man's all right.
MacGruber, Darren swears by it.
MacGruber's legit.
So this is going to be interesting. It's mostly going to... I'm going to be coming to most of these fresh.
It's going to be a hot summer.
I'm looking at Blues Brothers... estimated $27 million budget worldwide. It made $115,229,890. So that's
just theatrical, not like home video and all that. Right?
It doesn't say. It doesn't break it down on Wikipedia.
I think it
says
just
box office revenue. So I'm assuming that's theatrical.
Yeah. That would be original theatrical.
I have the USA gross was like 57,000.
Yeah, 57 million.
Not thousand. Good lord.
Yeah, when Landis releases the 3D version on IMAX, it's going to be legit.
Well, that's something to look forward to, I guess.
The Blues Brothers universe.
Oh, my God. The Bluesiverse.
But let's see. We have a few other odds and ends. We haven't gotten any new reviews on iTunes yet. Please rate and review us on iTunes. That really does help us out. If nothing else, that gives us something to read at the end of the show. But we had a nice thing on the Twitter. We had Jordash Dewan Jordan, which I love that name.
What a name.
He writes, I feel like the SNL Nerds show really fills in my blind spots for retro SNL sketches that I either forgot or never saw. And he has a link to the Liev Schreiber Invest Brothers sketch from this season.
That's a great sketch.
That was one of our favorites of the year. So that was So thank you very much for that, Jordash.
Thanks, Jordash.
And you can follow us on Twitter at SNL Nerd Show. We also have individual Twitter accounts.
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Darren Credible. That's D-A-R-I-N Credible.
And you can follow me on Twitter at Trumbull Comic. And I'm not going to spell that for you. Look at the show notes.
Yeah. So figure it out.
And you can also follow us on non-productive.com and contribute to our Patreon there.
Yeah.
And anything else? Do we have any plugs we got coming up?
No.
Nothing going on.
I'll be doing a show in Suffern, New York on Thursday, June 6th. So come on out to that at the Rhino Comedy Club. So
cool.
So aside from that, that's all I got.
All right. So next week, I believe we are going to do Wayne's World, which was the big hit of 1992.
That was such a huge hit.
So
I mean, Maron.
That's going to be interesting. So I haven't watched that movie in many a year. So
it's been a while since I've seen it. I can't wait to
to revisit it.
To dive into that baby again.
All right. So until then, we'll see you.
See you guys.
This has been a Non-Productive Media presentation. Executive producer, Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.